Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the Kia Exceed plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. It's not surprising that people are beginning to look at the UK figures on the rollout of the vaccine and just are agog with the comparison. There are now over 13 million first doses of vaccine administered in the UK. That's 24% of the adult population, according to their own figures, over 18. There are 153,000 in Ireland. That's the UK have administered 87 times as many vaccines as Ireland, and the UK has now administered more vaccines than the rest of Europe combined, believe it or not. The difference is just incredible. And that's what a number of our listeners want to ask about. David Hanshaw. David, good afternoon.
How are you doing, Joe?
Your point, please.
Well, Joe, I have a problem with how this has been rolled out. See, on last weekend, I was listening to people, government spokesmen, go on, turning around and saying the vaccine is here or it's coming on Sunday and will start being administered on Monday. Now, to me, if the vaccine was here on the Saturday, they should have been in vaccinating people.
Okay. Can I ask you, David, give an answer, a question I don't normally ask. What age group are you, David?
I'm 81, Joe.
Have you been informed yet by your GP of when your vaccine is due?
I haven't, Joe. And my problem is, Joe, that I've got a hell of a bucket list yet to try and get filled in and places to see. And it's more urgent for me than anybody else. So that's my attitude.
Now, do you know anyone older than you and if they've been informed about the vaccine?
14 years older than me and he still hasn't had the vaccine.
Sorry, that you were cut there. Is your brother is?
Billy Henshaw.
Yeah, and how many years older than you is Billy?
14.
14, okay. And he's in his 90s, his mid-90s?
Yes, and his wife is similar.
And he's in the community and he hasn't been informed by his GP?
Not that I know of. In the last 2 days I've spoke to him since late yesterday.
Okay, stay with us. 515, one more chance. Anthony, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe, how are you?
I want to do Pat Morrissey first? I do. Pat Morrissey.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
You're in Waterford.
I am. Yes.
And you're about the vaccine as well. Yes, you are. Go ahead. What's your point, please, Pat?
Yeah, I don't have my admission. I'm 70 years of age. I had the old bird. But I'm a full-time carer for my husband. Unfortunately, he had a leg amputation 11 years ago and open heart surgery 10 years ago. So he's more or less wheelchair bound, but can shower and dress and all that sort of thing. But I feel it's very unfair that the professional carers will get it before us. Say people who are paid to come in and care for somebody. I do it because he's my husband and I want to do it.
Yeah.
I don't have any help. I haven't asked for any help. But I think we should be given the vaccine ASAP. I go out shopping about 3 times a week. I go for the odd walk. Other than that, I do nothing because I'm terrified I'll get it. And if I do, my husband will end up in a nursing home.
Well, it says over 70s, which is a good age. But
I'm 70. Okay, and my husband is 79.
You should have the vaccine by mid-May, according to the HSE.
Mid-May, Joe. This is like it's not even mid-February.
February, March, April, May. Yeah.
Stay in for the rest of the whole clinic in 3 months.
Okay, Anthony, the vaccine again is and your concerns. Go ahead, Anthony.
Yes, Joe. Well, my concern is really for people who have no voice, and that's people with intellectual disabilities. My own sister has Down syndrome and she's 50. She's living in support with residential care and gets great care. But neither her nor her friends in the house with her, nor the carers, nor the organisation has any idea when they're going to get vaccinated.
And has have they inquired?
They have, yes. And they've inquired And the local HSC, as far as they can tell, it's all decisions are coming from high above. They answer as best they can that it'll be coming soon. But really, if you're rolling out such a big program, even indicative dates, if you don't have a target of dates to achieve, everything just goes by the way.
Well, the problem surely is supply, and the EU have made an absolute total mess of the supply. They were late in ordering, they were late in ponying up the money, and even in countries like France, even manufacturers of vaccines in countries like France are selling the vaccine to the UK first because the UK got in first, which is causing uproar in France, you can imagine.
That's all correct, Joe, but I think it's gone past the time that we stop standing in line like good little boys, because Germany has done a solo and they've bought over the excess vaccines from Bulgaria and Hungary. Now, we are still standing in line, and all your previous speakers there before are very, very vulnerable people. So we stood in line. I think our political establishment are really afraid to say that to the EU Commission, You made the hands of it, and we are not happy.
And where have you looked at this grid about where would your daughter stand on the list of priorities?
She's down about nine. And really, my personal opinion is that she should be certainly getting it next week with a rollout to over 70s. Because she's highly vulnerable. They've all underlying conditions, not just my sister, but the other people that she lives with in the supported accommodation, have all underlying heart issues and type 1 diabetes. And all these things are right up there as being, if they get COVID, it's a virtual death sentence. So, I will worry every day about her and about her friends. So we've heard everything about, and rightly so, about the nursing homes and the vulnerable people. But there's people with intellectual disabilities all over the country, either living at home and are vulnerable, or living and more vulnerable, living in supported residential care with about five or six people in a house and a couple of carers each day. That's about eight people. And, rely on the good work of the carers, and they've done tremendous work to date, that they have no incidents of COVID in the organisation that my sister is being supported with. And that just goes down to the super level of care that she's getting.
Now, the other angle is the way the UK, well, they've leapfrogged ahead of everyone else in the world at this stage for a number of reasons. One is Brexit, that they were able to go alone. The other country, Hungary, went alone as well. That's in the EU.
No, Joe, but we were able to go alone too, Joe. It's not that they went alone. Brexit has nothing got to do with it. It said, okay, we are a well-developed industrial nation. We're a rich nation.
We're a pharmaceutical nation in terms of our infrastructure now and our industry.
I think that it's a lot of subservience to the EU Commission. And it has done us no favours this time, So I really think that
Well, the other thing the UK have done is they've stretched out the administration of the second dose. In other words, they said
we haven't.
We're holding back the few doses we've got. We're 1,000 a day, which is minuscule. I know it's 1,000 people, 1,000 families, which is fantastic, but it's minuscule compared to the population, unfortunately. But what the UK have done is that they've said every vaccine we get, we're going to get it out there, administer it. Whereas the Irish have said every vaccine we get, you divide by two because it's two per person.
Well, are you going there for quantity over quality? That's a debate for another day. But if we are led to believe the most important thing of the vaccine, any vaccine that's been done there, if you even get one shot, you're basically not going to go in hospital and die alone in ICU. Now, let's get the one shot.
Okay. You agree with get them out there.
Yes, I do with the quantity, because the scientists and the people in the know and the clinical people have said one shot will stop the worst effects of COVID.
Yeah.
And I have my sister and our friends down there living daily with the sword of Damocles over their head.
just the worry, the worry, the worry.
Yes.
And when you hear stories on this programme, other programmes about long COVID especially, and unfortunately
and
singing doesn't seem to do
a lot of COVID and long COVID. My God.
Okay, David Anthony Pat, thanks indeed. I'm going to go straight to Nicola. Nicola, good afternoon. 1857 15 815 joe@rt.ie. Long COVID. Long COVID. It's officially recognised by the NHS in the UK. And as of this morning, reading the London Times, they reckon that the Danny Mortimer, who's chief executive of the NHS Federation, says up between 5 and 10% of people who get COVID, he reckons now will get long COVID. That this will be. Have to be tackled by the NHS for years to come, for many years to come. Now, you believe you have long COVID, Nicola. Why? What happened?
Well, I was diagnosed with COVID on the 4th of January, and
okay.
I'm 5 weeks in now, and my symptoms have persisted. I'm not sure that would be considered long COVID, but, you know, certainly the symptoms that I have been ongoing for that long. And, you know, I mean, I'm looking at a long road ahead with regards to the information from my consultant and, you know, how long it's going to take to recover from this.
And some of your symptoms symptoms are extraordinarily worrying, but some of them are very distressing, your hair, your teeth.
Yeah, I mean, it's things that I never personally would have associated with COVID. I'm a 46-year-old woman, perfectly healthy, don't drink, don't smoke. And, you know, over the last 5 weeks, I have lost over stone and weight. My teeth have loosened. I've lost my hair on top of everything else that's associated with COVID, which is, you know, the breathlessness, the fatigue, the chronic pain. You know, debilitating headaches, all of those things, you know, and they're ongoing every day. You know, my
symptoms. And have you been given any indication? I know on that list, maybe your hair is down the list, but have you been told, well, your hair will grow back?
It's not something that's really high on my agenda at the moment, you know, because
and what
of
about your
else
teeth?
That's going on.
Your teeth?
My teeth, you know, hopefully, you know, when I start getting healthier and get proper nutrients in, you know, that will change as well. I have looked for advice on it, you know, but again, it's something that nobody would have associated with COVID before. You know, it's not something that you read every day. And I think people need to understand the dangers and the, you know, the symptoms that are associated with it that people aren't hearing about. And, you know, that people need to be informed that these things possibly can happen to you. You know, I mean, here I am and I'm heading into my sixth week now and it's still all ongoing, you know.
And the other thing the other issue you want to bring to is the effect on children. Tell me, if you wish, the effect on your own child.
Yeah, well, I have two children. My daughter is 11 and my son is 6. And I mean, they've struggled over the last number of weeks because of this. They've seen their mother going from being perfectly healthy to being, you know, debilitated, having to be cared for basically 24/7. You know, I had to leave them. I ended up in hospital a couple of weeks ago and I was in hospital for 6 weeks or sorry, 6 days in a COVID ward. And, you know, it happened kind of early in the morning. I had to get an ambulance and I left here without getting an opportunity to say goodbye to my children. And, you know, when I returned from hospital, my features had changed and my children were, you know, they recoiled kind of away from me when they saw me because, you know, of the impact that it had on me, on my appearance, physically and emotionally. And I think children they're suffering anyway, emotionally, because of lockdown and being away from their family and friends. And then to have this in a home as well is extremely traumatic and stressful for them. And I feel that really intervention needs to be provided from the government, you know, to allow children to receive what they need with regards to support, emotional support, whether it's through, you know, primary care services or GP services in regards to, you know, just being able to go and talk to somebody and give parents support as to how they can explain this to children and the impacts that it has on families. And I think that's really important. I think there's a stigma associated with COVID. People don't like to talk about it. And a lot of people only speak about the physical impact. But it's the emotional, I think, that will stay on long after the pandemic is over.
And Nicola, how long were you in hospital for?
I was in hospital for 6 days, but I've been in I was in isolation for 32 days away from my family.
And what's that like emotionally on you?
It's extremely stressful. It's extremely traumatic. I mean, you're at your lowest, and when you're sick, all you want to be is surrounded by your family and to be cared for. So it's the sensory deprivation. It's the sensory, you know, like it's the emotional deprivation, the physical deprivation.
Yeah.
And it has a huge impact on people. And, you know, I mean, I would consider myself a strong person, but I struggled, you know, I struggled every day and I continue to struggle, you know, with it. You see your children from a distance. You can't hold them when you know that they're sad or that they're lonely or, you know, that they're scared. And all you, as a mother, as a parent, all you want to do is be there with them. And physically, you cannot do that for them.
And what medication are you on now for COVID, Nicola?
At the moment, I am on high doses of steroids, antibiotics and painkillers.
Wow.
On a daily basis, just to get through. And even at that, you know, there's still a lot of pain, still an awful lot of pain every day. Yeah. And it's not that you'd even have a good day. You'd have maybe 2 or 3 hours in the day that you can say, yeah, I'm doing OK. You know, apart from that, then it's literally
and you say,
hour by hour.
I want the public to be aware of how devastating this disease can be. And frontline workers are continuing to be at risk due to some members of the public dismissing guidelines.
Absolutely. I mean, what I witnessed in the hospital, you know, what the nurses and the doctors do every day to put themselves out there at risk. They're going home to their own families. You know, they, you know, even in the COVID ward, what they have to do to put on their PPE gear every time they go to a patient, every time they leave the room, they have to strip off. And then literally 2 minutes again, another bell is going off and they have to come back in. And even inside a COVID ward, I mean, I know people watched that show last night, but to be physically in those wards and to witness what happens literally minute by minute, you know.
But what is that like? Describe that to us, if you can.
It's very difficult, you know. I mean, I found that the most traumatic, I have to say, when I was in hospital because, you know, like I said, you're deprived of visitors, you know, you're depending on, and again, incredible staff. I mean, literally you're at your lowest and a nurse will pass by and she'll see that you're, you know, you're not feeling great. And all it was she reached out and touched your arm. And it was just somebody letting you know that they're there for you and that they know what you're going through and that they understand. And I mean, most of the staff that I spoke to, I was in St. Luke's Hospital in Kilkenny. Most of the staff that I spoke to had gone through COVID. They had all been through it. And these people come back in, day out, and they do their job without a care. The love, the compassion that I felt while I was down there, I will never, ever forget it.
Okay,
but from a point of view, from a patient, what you experience down there is like nothing. You know, you're hearing people at their lowest, and especially nighttime was the most difficult because you were completely alone. And at nighttime, people kind of tend to I suppose, like, you know, you can hear people praying, you can hear people, you know, crying in their beds, and you can't do anything. You can't do anything for these people, you know, like you can't be with them. You have to be on your own. And it's just, it's horrendous, you know, unless you witness that. And I mean, people dismiss COVID, people say it's only a flu. And thankfully, you know, for most people who get COVID, yes, it is only a flu. But not everybody is that lucky. And I was unfortunate enough, and so many other people, you know, who end up in hospital, you know, for me to be perfectly healthy and to end up the way that I have ended up, I don't know how long this is going to last. I'm looking at probably 3 months, if not 6 months. And I don't know what the long term impact on my lungs are because of this. But I know I have a road ahead of me, you know, and that's without any underlying issues. So I just, you know, I need people to understand the impact that they're and the consequences that their actions have. If people go out there and they don't care for themselves, you know, have respect for other people and, you know, wear your mask and be conscious of other people and what they're going through. And that's, you know, that was the message that I wanted to get across.
Yeah. And Nicola, do people forget that even yesterday's figure, some of it pertained to January, that in January, last month in Ireland, it's now well over 1,000 people died of COVID.
Yes.
That's an unprecedented catastrophe in Ireland.
It is. And, you know, you can't fob those figures off. They're there. You know, that's a life gone.
I know.
That's that's families devastated, and it, more so the fact that you can't actually even grieve, you know, and you can't be with that person. And that's the most, you know, that's the most difficult part.
I was thinking of it. I shouldn't say this, but I was thinking of it the other day. I was watching, I'm not a big rugby fan, but I'm not a great sports fan. But I was watching the two ads, one on Virgin Media, I think, and one on RTE, including this station, for the Six Nations. And both of them had this type of guff. We've had a tough winter. You can say that again. Over 1,000 people dead. And you can't have a tough winter, but let the Six Nations raise our spirits. You ever hear such... such tone-deaf ads in all your life. But anyway, that's my aside, because I want to iterate and reiterate what you were saying, Nicola, about from inside these COVID wards, that people realise what not that what we are facing, but what people have gone through for nearly a year now, January being the worst month in I can't think of any other event. No. And I don't want to think of any other event that could be compared to. It is so unbelievably catastrophic. Nicola, stay with us. I want to bring Tony Doyle in, 1850-715-815. Tony, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
It's nearly a year ago, March 2020, COVID arrived in your life.
Yeah, it would have been, March 10th I started getting symptoms. So, yeah, it's almost 12 months, but sure, I'm still here. That's the main thing.
Yeah, and tell us your initial symptoms and your initial treatment and what you went through.
I started getting sick, as I say, on the 10th of March, and I had the sort of the three classic symptoms at the time, which was shortness of breath, the dry cough, and the fever. But at that time, now bear in mind, it was early March, they hadn't really been testing at that stage. This was just probably after the incident in Northern Italy, and the criteria was you either had to be arriving back in from Northern Italy or you had to be in close contact with somebody who had COVID. I didn't meet any of them, so I was waiting around to get tested. I've had the flu before. I had the flu before. I'm 55 now. I had the flu before when I was about 24.
That's young.
So, but the reason I'm saying that is because I know the difference between the actual flu and a cold.
Okay.
People say, I have a dose of the flu all the time, but the flu is a bad enough thing. But what I'd say about COVID and the flu, it's like comparing a house cat with a tiger. They're not the same. And as I say, I got those symptoms. I was waiting for a good week and a bit. So the day after St. Patrick's Day, the wife said, no, forget about this. I'm calling an ambulance. She called the ambulance. The ambulance arrived, I don't know, around about 8 o'clock in the evening. Guy arrived in full hazmat gear, like something out of a movie. And luckily I was able to walk out. I walked out to the ambulance and sirens going, or the flashing beacons going off and neighbours looking out, and very surreal, you know. And I went into hospital anyway. I went to St. James's. After a few days, I had gone down sort of fairly rapidly. They brought me into ICU, and then, I think that was on the Wednesday I was brought in. By the Monday, I was on a ventilator. And I was on it for, I said in the email, 21 days. I was actually on it for 19 days. Not much of a difference, but however.
Can you remember that, Tony?
I can remember most of vividly. I remember going in. The worst part of this for me was probably when the consultant came in and says, we're going to have to put you on the ventilator. It'll be only for a few days to give your lungs a rest. That's the way it was sort of. He was probably sugarcoating it. He asked me, did I want to ring the wife? And to be honest, I just couldn't do it at the time. I asked him to ring her. I asked him to try and sugarcoat it if he could. You know, so in fairness, he did. But the worst part for me then was the waiting to go on it. So between that conversation with the consultant and actually going on the ventilator was probably about an hour.
Okay.
So I'm sitting there wondering, what should I do? Should I record messages? Should I... I'm sorry.
Yeah, take your time.
No, you see, I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
So I eventually sort of copped on to myself and said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to get through this. I'm going to fight it. And thankfully I did. But as I say, I didn't realise it would be. It was Good Friday actually when I came off the ventilator. So I had no concept of time between whatever it was the 24th of March and Good Friday. I hadn't realised I was out for that long. Somebody must have mentioned it to me, because when I was talking to my wife for the first time, I'd asked her where was the Easter egg. So I had, somebody had told me, but at that stage you're so sort of hopped up, if you like, on medication that you don't know night from day, from wrong. And so there was usual things I'm sure people would have had. I had vivid hallucinations. I remember them like they were yesterday, whereas a friend of mine I know who was also on a ventilator up in Talla, she was on it for 10 days. And as far as I know, she had no memory of being in hospital. So it hits people differently. I'd say it's like getting, if you're getting COVID, it's like getting a lottery ticket. You could win or you could be just going through it. You know, and thankfully most people, a reverse lottery, so to speak, most people will get it and they'll get mild enough symptoms and they'll get through it. But then with this long COVID, as it's known now, you'll get people who have mild symptoms and are suffering horrendous side effects after it. Mm-hmm. And you get somebody like me who had a severe dose, and now I'm a bit overweight. I'm not huge or anything like that. Okay. I'm a bit overweight, but I was fairly fit. Never sick in my life. The only time I was ever in hospital was when I was hit by a car when I was a young set, but that's it. Never, no symptoms or no underlying conditions or anything like that. It just hit me like a ton of bricks. And for whatever reason, I don't know, and I still don't know. But as I say, thankfully, most people will get through it. But it's not an experience anybody wants to have.
And how are you now, Tony? You're just 11 months later.
Well, as I say, I consider myself to be one of the lucky ones, because I do have an issue with my lung, with my right lung. It's just not the same as it was. It could be a case that it never will be, but I can live with it if that's the case. At the moment, so I was motoring along. I was back in work. I was discharged at the end of April, and I was back in work by mid-June. And now I don't do anything physical, so I'm a supervisor, sort of point the finger and give out sort of thing, but that's about it. But I was back in work mid-June, motoring along, still had the issue with my lung, weak, shortness of breath, and you get very tired. So when I stop work, I'd be exhausted, absolutely exhausted, even though I might just be sitting in front of a laptop or driving around various different places. But as soon as I stopped, I'd be exhausted. And then you get days where you get, as it's been described, this brain fog, and you just can't concentrate. You just can't
that brain fog. What about sleeping at night, Tony?
No, I was until the winter time. I have an issue now with me throat, where it tightens up. Now, I don't know whether it's an inflammatory thing. I don't know whether it's because I had the tube down me with the ventilator. I don't know what it is. And the problem is, that's stopping me sleeping at night time. If I sit a certain way, if I lie down a certain way, it just tightens up. It's like something is grabbing you by the throat. And as I say, so...
Okay, Tony, stay with us. I'll come back to you, I promise. But I just want to get Beryl in again on the vaccine rollout. Beryl Booth. Beryl, hello. Good afternoon. Just before the break, I want to talk to you.
Yeah.
Beryl, sorry for holding you there.
Okay.
The vaccine.
Yeah. No, I'm nearly 102 and I haven't heard a thing.
Right.
And also, I have carers coming in every day and they haven't heard anything. They're from an organisation and they have, up to this morning, they had heard nothing about them getting vaccinated, which I think is wrong.
You're 102. Congratulations, and many more years.
I'm not that yet. I have still a bit to go.
I know. I'm saying many. Well, just 100 coming.
April.
Okay, you're just 102.
Yeah.
And you haven't heard a word about the vaccine.
No. And also, as I say, these carers who should be getting it haven't heard any words up to this morning, anyway.
And have you asked, Beryl?
I didn't ask.
That you should have to, but...
I don't like pestering people. I'm sure people are ringing up all the time.
But have you had any reason to contact your GP lately?
No. Oh, thank goodness it happened.
Great. Well, I'm saying your GP is the one who will be...
Yes, I suppose so, but you'd imagine they're supposed to be contacting you when you are going to have it.
Yeah.
So I was just waiting and hoping that I would be contacted and where I'd have to go.
And you'd jump at it, you would...
I could guess my daughter would bring me to wherever I have to go, if I have to go anywhere.
But you've no hesitation getting it.
No, oh no.
Absolutely.
I'd be first on the list.
Well done. But how have you managed in the pandemic, Beryl?
Ah, I'm all right. I've had a few experiences of being incarcerated, if you like, at home. Not in prison.
Not yet. You're still young, Beryl. You're still young.
But yeah, yes.
But you were born so in 1919.
Well, I believe there was somebody of 110 in Wales.
Yeah, and there's a nun in France.
I don't think I'd like to be that long because everybody else would be so old. And...
Okay.
They wouldn't be able to look after me.
No, the reason I'm saying 1919 is you were born when the pandemic,
yes.
The Spanish flu was raging around
the
world.
Yes, I had an aunt whom I never knew. She died at the age of 28 from the Spanish flu.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
My father's sister.
Yeah.
But, I'm grand. I'm very well, actually. I'm very lucky. But I just don't want to get the bug. And I would like to get the vaccine. I've had the flu vaccine since about 1957. I've had
good
it every
woman.
Year.
Good woman. Well done.
I got flu once, and I said, if there's anything I can do to prevent myself getting it, I'm going to do it. So my brother happened to be a doctor, and he used to give us the injection every year, the whole family, my father and mother and ourselves.
Well, you heard, I don't know if you heard Tony Doyle there while you were waiting earlier, who was just talking to Tony, said comparing COVID, which you're not doing, but he's just giving a really strong comparison. Comparing COVID with the flu is like comparing a house cat with a tiger.
Yes,
they're just
exactly.
not the same. So I would have thought everyone over 90 was already vaccinated, but not you.
No. And my children now are in their 70s.
Of course,
So,
have any of them heard, do you know?
Pardon?
Have any of them heard, Beryl, about being vaccinated?
No.
Okay.
One lives down in Enniscorthy and the other in Dublin.
Okay.
And they haven't heard anything.
And where did you live for most of your life? I know you're in County Dublin.
Shankill.
Shankill.
In Shankill for 72 years in the same house.
Well done. Okay, Beryl Booth, just coming up to 102. Would love to know when you're getting your vaccine.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Beryl. That's Beryl in Shankill in Dublin. 51551, watch out.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-8155.
And Joe at RT.ie, talking about two items today that our listeners are really, really anxious to talk about. One is long COVID and two is the rollout of the vaccine. And you heard there just before the break, Beryl Booth, just coming up to 102, hasn't heard a word about the vaccine. Wendy O'Dea, prior to last March, as you say, you completed two full marathons. What happened after that, Wendy?
Hi, Joe. Good morning, or good afternoon, I should say. So it was the very last week in February of last year. I just woke one morning and like that, it was like my body had been hit by a bus. It's the only way I can describe it. I had aches and pains all over. Trying to even get out of the bed was a struggle. So I didn't know what was going on. I rang the GP, requested an appointment, went to see the GP. My husband had to take a day off to drive me over because I couldn't do anything for myself. Drove her over to the GP and he did all the usual tests. I did have a high temperature while I was there. He said it was the flu. He did ask me if I had travelled outside of the country or if I had been in contact with anyone. Mm-hmm. Who had been out of the country, and I hadn't at that time that I was aware of. So he said I didn't fit the criteria for a COVID-19 test at the time. So basically, the treatment was to rest. I was signed off work for 2 weeks and home and rest. So I couldn't do anything else anyway. So it was basically lying down for 2 weeks. I had no appetite. I just felt awful, basically. Aches and pains everywhere. The cough was present, but it wasn't too bad. It wasn't taking my breath away or anything. But certainly all the other symptoms of pain, complete fatigue. So the end of the 2 weeks came anyway, and I was due back to work. And I went back to work, still didn't feel 100%, but I thought, okay, it'll just take a little bit more time for me to fully recover. As he said, it was maybe just a bad flu. So I went back to work. Now I work on the front line in healthcare. And
you're in a hospital.
When I went back, I'm in a hospital, an acute setting, yes. Yeah. So when I returned to work, I work with cancer patients, and I love my job. So I was in my own job for the week when I returned, but then obviously everything kind of started to escalate in Ireland in relation to COVID-19, and the hospital started to become busier and busier with patients being admitted. So I was asked if I would redeploy to one of the COVID wards to work with the staff on one of these wards. And I said, no problem, I will be happy to. I was working on these wards for about 3 weeks. And then I was back to square one. It was again, woke up one morning and I couldn't move. Wow. Been hit by a bus again, sore throat, the cough. And I just had to take to the bed again. I rang the GP to explain. He said, okay, this time we need to do a swab. At this point, they were doing swabs. So I got the swab, but it came back negative. And so basically it was, again, a two-week period of being signed off work to rest. And it was nearly kind of like when I rang work to say my swab was negative, it was nearly, can you come back to work? I was like, no, I'm not well enough to come back to work at the time. So I just stayed in bed again for 2 weeks. Again, very little appetite. But in the middle of this 2 week, it was, I couldn't even walk from my bed to the ensuite toilet without being totally out of breath. Wow. At one stage, my husband, he was actually quite scared. He said, Wendy, I want you to get checked out. This is not right. Yeah. So he brought me into the A&E in the hospital that I work in. Now, when I went in and they checked me over, my oxygen saturations on the machine were within normal range, despite me being short of breath. So they said, listen, Wendy, this is not the place for you. You just need to go home and take care of yourself. Because obviously in the COVID A&E, as they had separated from the normal A&E, it was, you know, full of query COVID-positive patients. My swab was negative, so they said they didn't want me in there. So go home, rest yourself and mind yourself. So I did. And then the end of the 2 weeks, okay, back to work. Back to work in the COVID ward. And it was just very, I was like, what is wrong with me? As in, I'm COVID negative according to the swab. I have to return to work as if everything's okay. Keep going. I said, right, maybe I need to just do a little bit of exercise to try and get my energy back on top of working full time and home life, family, child, the rest.
Yeah, yeah.
So I tried because I like to be active. I like to keep fit. I joined a group on our local beach who were doing social distance exercise at the time. It was laid outside. And it was kind of like HIIT classes. And I would normally be well into it, well able for it as well. And I just found that my body wasn't able to keep up. My head wanted me to do it, but my body couldn't do it.
And do you think, Wendy, that you have long COVID? And it sounds, given some of the symptoms you're talking about, sounds so familiar to Lifeline listeners the last 24 hours.
Yeah.
Now, the HSE, you've said people who have been discharged, re-long COVID, we asked them, people who have been discharged from hospital following COVID-19 are followed up as appropriate by their team, i.e. the team of the hospital. People in the community who are concerned about persistent COVID-19 symptoms should contact their GP. A national approach to long COVID is currently under consideration. But you're saying it's not showing up on scans or whatever, but you feel it.
I have no doubt in my own mind and in my own body that I went through it. if you understand. I know I did go through it. And the fact that I'm now almost 1 year, coming up to the 1 year since I first had the symptoms, and I'm still going through phases where I'll be back to square one. And recently, I've had episodes where I've been, you know, almost fainting to the ground. And I recently had to have, I was in work one day and I was sent down to A&E to get checked out because I was so unwell in work. They did a lot of tests on me, another swab test that came back negative. You know, obviously this is like nearly 10 months, 11 months later on after my first initial symptom, so it would be negative. But everything came back, blood came back normal, chest x-ray normal. But they did request a Holter monitor because my heart rate, every time I walk around or go to do anything, my heart rate was starting to rise abnormally high. And this had been the case throughout the year as well. When I try to walk upstairs, which I always do in work, I become extremely short of breath, high heart rate, for no reason. So basically, I had a Holter monitor, which is where they attach a monitor on your heart, and it was for 48 hours. So I took it home with me. It stayed attached for 48 hours. Now, bear in mind, I was after being in A&E for almost a day, being checked out. So I spent 2 days.
I have to remind listeners, A&E in your own hospital where you work.
Absolutely, yeah. And in fairness, they were very good to me. They did a thorough checkout, but didn't come across anything that was totally abnormal. They just put it down to post-viral fatigue and problems. So I went home and I rested for the 2 days that I had the Holter monitor on. But the one time I did get up to walk was to walk, you know, to get back to the hospital to bring back the Holter monitor. And from the results, I went back to a cardiologist then last week to receive the result, and my heart rate had gone up to 154. So from lying around doing nothing and just walking slowly to bring back the Holter monitor, my heart rate went up to 154,
which is
totally abnormal for me,
and which is not uncommon from what we're hearing. Stay with us, Wendy. I want to bring Joe Kelly. Joe, you got COVID last March.
Yes, Joe.
And how are you feeling now?
Oh, I feel good. I'm not back to normal by any stretch of the imagination. My breathing is the problem. That's the worst thing. It started in March last year.
Right.
I was perspiring profusely.
Okay.
Couple of nights, changing my bedclothes and everything. So in the end, a long story short, I was being sent for a COVID test, and my son Robbie down to Sir John Rogers Quay. That time, their boat was down there.
Okay.
And the minute they saw me, they said, "Get him into the hospital." So I went, my son Robbie, to Tala. I spent 4 weeks in Tala. I was very bad. I was quite bad.
Yeah.
I was really bad. There's a lot I don't remember because I lost over 2 stone of weight. You know, I was in ICU. But I did 4 weeks, and they let me out after 4 weeks. I don't know why. But
and you remember your time in ICU, Joe?
Very little of it.
Okay.
Just a lot of activity, really. But
and you remember what was going through your head, or
the worst part is. I was so bad, like in isolation. I was very bad, you know, in isolation. You know, you're on your own, and you can't speak to anyone. No one can speak to you. The nurses come in, all dressed up, and you don't know what they look like even. But they let me out after 4 weeks, and I thought I started improving, but I got worse. I had the diarrhea, and I wasn't interested in food. I lost my taste of smell and my taste of anything. And so after a week or two weeks, I decided, look, my sons and my family, you're not right, rang the GP, get you back. But this time I said, I'm going back to James's because they had all my particulars. I always went to James's because I have an underlying problem with my heart. I've an ICD fitted inside of my body, you know.
Okay.
So I went back to James, and right enough, I was very bad there. They started treating me, and it got a bit worse, and I was in isolation there for quite a long time. I got so bad, like, my lowest ebb there was, at one stage, as I said, I hadn't spoken to any of my family for so many weeks, and no one had seen me, and I was lost so much weight. I was basically a second skeleton. I thought So I said, then two doctors came up. I presume they were doctors.
Yeah.
And they're talking to you about your end of life requests. So that would really actually the doctor stuffing out of me. So I said,
and what was that conversation? Can you remember that conversation? I'm sure you do.
Well, they said you're a very sick man.
Yeah.
Joseph, they said you're very sick. Yeah. Very, very sick. Yeah. And you have so many other problems with your heart and your kidneys because the COVID has affected your lungs and your kidneys.
Yeah.
And you said if anything happens to you in the hospital here now, up in this ward, we feel that we might do damage. If we get you down to the ICU, we might do damage to your body. You wouldn't survive. So they just said we have to ask your end of life request. Like, what would you? So that really shook me. You know, absolutely shattered. Oh, I just said to them, look, the whole thing, I don't want to be left like a vegetable in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Just let me go. But when they went, then I was really, I said, in a lonely place on my own in the ward on my own. I said to myself, I remember saying to myself, well, I have to beat this. I have to get home to my family. My wife was at home on her own. Well, her, the family were looking after her. So from then on, I don't know what it was. I prayed and I got determined to get back.
And it's also the care you were getting, in fairness. Like,
oh, yes.
Determination.
Absolutely.
Like, it's,
yes.
You know.
Yes. The care was great, absolutely great. And even to this day, when I left, they're still great. I'm still under the care.
Okay.
I joined they have a team working with Trinity College, the COVID team, and do the study of that.
Right.
I joined that, I remember that.
And, but Joseph, what was your understanding of when the two medics said to you, end of life? When they left, your understanding was...
I was near death. I felt like that, Joe. I did feel I was looking down the black hole. You know, I did feel that because I was very, very sick.
Yeah, I know.
Very, very. And I couldn't walk. I couldn't do anything. I had all sorts of things going on.
But your understanding was that if you got worse, God forbid.
If anything happened or I had an attack, they were just said. I didn't think my body would stand up to be resuscitated.
Okay, so
basically.
they wouldn't bring you back to ICU.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But then I said, I terrible with the help of them, obviously the treatment I got in James's, I think with my determination, I got better and better. And I came out of hospital on the 2nd of June last year. And I was weak and all like that. But I did everything they told me. I started eating well, and I got my taste back and my smell back.
Okay.
And ever since then, now, every morning at 8:30, I'm up at 8:30. I do 3/4 of an hour of exercises downstairs, like leg exercises with little weights and on my arms and with a little bicycle and all. I do that. And if the weather permitting, I'll go for a walk.
Yeah.
And just myself and my wife are together. I'm 83.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things. But if I do anything, if I exercise, do anything hard, I go out of breath. But lucky enough now, I sleep great. Other than I have to wait for the usual things at night, go to the bathroom. But apart from that, I sleep well. And I have a terrible lot to be thankful for.
And Joseph, just when you were told again, like the two medics said, listen, you've a lot of what you've underlying. You're in a terrible, difficult situation. Did you pray? Did you?
Yes.
And who do you pray to? Do you have a special devotion to anybody?
The Blessed Virgin.
The Blessed Virgin. Okay. And were you able to ring your wife or anybody or talk to your wife?
No. Oh, well, at times, at certain times, I was saying, no, my wife has a problem I don't want to discuss. But my son and my daughter are terrific. My son, David, and my daughter, Elaine.
Yeah.
She's in Limerick, but she's terrific.
Yeah, great. Well, they got that from their mum and dad.
Yeah.
Didn't they?
I don't I've a lot to be thankful for.
Yeah, I know. And that comes across. God, you've been through a lot.
Yeah.
You've been through a lot. Okay, Joe, stay well. I love your exercise regime at half. Mr. Motivator's only in the Abney Place, Joe, in the morning.
Well, before I got COVID, even though I was 82 years of age, I walked out in the gym 4 days a week. Brilliant. And I was very active. I played golf and I looked after my garden. I was always very active. Okay. Now, I'm back driving my car at all now.
Right, great.
And I'm walking around the blocks for half an hour to an hour's walk up at the park and that.
So it's only the breathing that's getting you at this stage.
The breathing, I know my lungs are affected. They're scarred, but there's not a lot I can do about that. But it's the balance between I'm on water. I only can drink a litre and a half of water a day because I have to. But with my heart complaint, you have to balance your kidneys and your heart.
Yeah.
They work in conjunction with one another. So you must keep that regime.
And you say you have an ICD, which is...
defibrillator.
Stopping all of it. If your heart stops all of a sudden, it's obviously bronchitis.
That'll kick
you back into life.
That's why my son said his inheritance is gone out the wall.
you live to well over 100 and beyond.
Exactly.
Okay, Joe. Thanks. Stay safe. And anyone, I know people saying you've a special devotion to Our Lady, Queen of Heaven, and the Blessed Virgin. I hope anyone who has belief would say a prayer for you to Our Lady, and indeed say a prayer for everyone.
Yes, indeed.
That is their belief. Okay, Joe. Joseph Kelly. Good to meet you, Mahogra. Joe. You too, Joe. You too.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Back to the vaccine rollout. Now, one listener points out correctly that one of the reasons why the UK have gone at the vaccine with a vengeance is that their initial response was such an absolute disaster. Their death rate in the UK was more than double the death rate here in Ireland, for example. And you all remember the carry-on of Boris Johnson at the start and going around shaking everyone's hand and saying a bit Trump-like that wasn't a big issue. But now they are rolling out the vaccine. Margaret Carroll, Margaret, you've made a comparison in where your daughter would be on the list in the UK as to compared to where she'd be here in terms of priority, let alone vaccine supply. But to tell us, please, Margaret.
That's correct. My daughter, Sarah, is 32, and she has Down syndrome. And I was listening to the news there at 1 o'clock or half one, and there was a GP on saying that it'll be 12 weeks before all the over 80s are vaccinated. Now, Sarah is, according to the HSE, I thought number 6 or 7, but I heard your previous caller saying it could be number 9. But anyway, that she's way down the list of priority. Mm. Now, in the NHS, the people with Down syndrome are number 4. They're in with the 70-year-olds. And the reason being is that they have dysregulation of the immune system. They are very, very vulnerable. The scientific and research papers show that they're 10 times more likely to become very ill if they get it, to become seriously ill, and the mortality rate is higher. So that's why they're number 4 on the NHS. They have been forgotten about here. You know, people with disabilities have been forgotten about, I believe, here. In many areas of the vaccination. But the other thing is that there's carers. I'm fine. I'm very healthy. But there's carers who are looking after children with disabilities, intellectual and physical disabilities, who have very serious medical issues as well. And they're very frail medically. And if their carer, if their parent gets COVID, you know, what's going to happen to that child or adult? They should be getting... I know the carers in nursing homes are being prioritised, and rightly so, but the carers in the home are equally, you know, for those lists of very vulnerable, where they're very, very vulnerable children or adults, medically vulnerable, those carers should also be prioritised, I believe, you know. So when I heard about that it'll be 12 weeks before all the over 80s, I thought, well, what hope has she got? I mean, people with intellectual disability, the adults have been at home for most of this pandemic, because she was working before this. She had a very active life. She had lots of activities. Now she's at home. And so it looks like she could be at home till the autumn. You know, her whole life, that's a year and a half of her life that she can't get back, you know, totally disrupted. You know, I just, it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating. Now, it wasn't for her, I mean, if it wasn't for her her service, Zoom classes and the activities they're providing, and I have to say her Special Olympics club, Southland Sports, they are just amazing. Right. Every weekend they step on They're absolutely fantastic.
Okay.
The same with her service. You know, if it wasn't for that, I don't know where we'd be at all, to be quite honest, you know. So, I mean, it's not as if she can, like, she can't go out on her own. It's not safe for her with this pandemic, you know, to go out on her own for a walk or that. I don't know who she's going to bump into or who she, you know, that isn't wearing a mask and coughs all over her or whatever. I just feel very protective of her right now, you know.
That's totally understandable.
Just very worried.
Okay, let your voice be heard, Margaret, and that of Sarah as well. Thank you both. Alwyn, good afternoon, Alwyn. You're in North Sydney GP practice.
Good afternoon, Joe.
What have you been told about the vaccine delivery?
Obviously, I was driving home, and I suppose really what I want to get across to your listeners is that GPs, practice nurses, we are ready to go. So, for instance, a lady earlier was just saying that she hadn't heard from her GP. So basically, the way it's going to work is that as soon as we get the vaccine, we have our lists ready. So, for instance, in our practice, I have made contact with some of the people. And some of the people, I have their phone numbers. Some people, I have their consent to text them. So I'm quite confident that most GPs in Ireland are literally ready to go. We have the lists.
And have you been given any indication, Alwyn, when?
So basically what's going to happen, we were at the IMO webinar last night. So it's going to be the larger practices that have the larger numbers to start over the age of 85. So, for instance, our practice may not get rolling with the vaccine for the over 85 till the end of the first week in March. So it might be that on your street, somebody gets who's over 85 might get their vaccine quicker than their next door neighbour. And it's all to do with the logistics of getting the vaccines out to certain areas in the country and also to the practices.
So you've been told that the earliest you will be able to deal is the end of the first week of March.
Yeah, looking at my delivery schedule. Okay. And obviously they have to look at the logistics of getting these very temperamental vaccines frozen out to the practices. So,
but you're saying we, the GP practices, we're ready and able and waiting.
We're ready, we're able, we're waiting. Okay. And it just unfortunately is what it is, in the sense that they're doing their best to get the vaccine out. But once it's out, we will be in touch. And the plan is, as soon as the vaccine lands, we are going to count the vaccine. We're going to send our text messages out, or we will ring people. And then literally within 48 hours, the plan is that vaccine will be in everybody's arm.
And is every GP participating, do you know? Can you say, no, I don't want to give, I want to administer the vaccine?
So most practices, I believe, are getting involved. And then there's going to be, in Dublin, for instance, for smaller practices, they're going to have run in the Helix, large, where GPs can bring their patients to the Helix to get the vaccine.
Okay.
So, yeah, so there will be more publicity about it, obviously, but the main thing to get across is we're here, we're waiting. Don't be concerned. You won't be contacted.
That's a good point. Don't be worried about that. You're not on the list. That what the GPs are waiting for is the supply, and then they'll kick
it
out.
And the thing is, we all know our patients. And don't be worried. If a GP hasn't been in touch within 3 weeks, they will be in contact with you.
Okay, Alwyn. Thanks, Aline. Thank you for your service. 51551 Marchant.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Joe at RT.ie. Mark Johnson. Mark, good afternoon.
Good afternoon,
diagnosed, unfortunately, with COVID on the 10th of October last year.
Correct.
What happened next?
What happened next was I was isolating in the bedroom for the 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't too bad, probably, for the first week. But as the second week progressed, I was getting worse and worse. It was desperate headaches. The headache was outrageous. Couldn't bear the headache. Couldn't sleep at night time. Mm-hmm. I probably spent maybe 8 or 10 days without proper sleep. And I don't know whether it was that I couldn't sleep or I wouldn't sleep or I was afraid to sleep. I don't know what it was, but I was absolutely exhausted. And that's it was a terrible, terrible thing.
And was there any relief? You talked about this, the headaches were desperate. Was there any relief, any pain relief?
I took everything I had in the house, Joe, for headaches. You couldn't get near your doctor at that stage. You couldn't. They didn't want you, and that's understandable. But I took everything that there was there, and it eased it ever so slightly, but it was bad. It was really, really bad. Breathing problems, outrageous. I was out the window one night and I was watching the Late Late Show and this terrible tightness came over my chest. Mm-hmm. I opened up the window. There wasn't a lot of air out that particular night. I was pushing myself up and down on the windowsill trying to get air into my body.
Okay.
I was looking dead in the eyeballs that night. It was dreadful. But I had an inhaler there and I gave myself 7 or 8 puffs of it, way above the normal, what you should be giving you. But and it seemingly just clicked things into place and the breathing started settling down again. And I just struggled on through that weekend until next Monday when I could ring the doctor again and he prescribed me more medication. He gave me a load of different steroids and all that type of stuff. Now, my doctor, I have to say, was extremely helpful and very, very understanding because he knows I have a lot of bloody problems. I can't take a lot of stuff. I'm allergic to an awful lot of medication. And at his very, very, very best, he kept me out of hospital as best he could. Twice I was on borderline, and he told me that. He said, whatever care you're getting at home, obviously, is very, very good, and you've been well looked after, well cared for, and we'll do our best to keep you out of hospital. Because my fear was I go in there and they'll put something into me that I'll end up allergic to, and I won't be coming out.
And that, what was the phrase you used when you were trying to breathe out the window? You were looking in the eyeball.
I couldn't breathe, Joe. I couldn't get air into my lungs. And I was leaning out over the windowsill, out my head out the window, pushing myself up and down to try and get me lungs working, basically, to try and suck air back into my body to give me some kind of relief. It was dreadful. Dreadful. I then developed some kind of blackening and mottling off the lower part of my body. And I didn't know what it was, but by the time I got into my doctor and I told him this, I could see by his face, he was horrified.
And what was it again, Mark?
It was black mottling off my legs and my private parts.
This is your discoloration, yeah.
And he says to me, do you realise how lucky you are to be standing there talking to me? I says, why? He says, that was sepsis. That was the start of sepsis, he said. So he said, look, you're in a very sticky situation at the moment. Go home, mind yourself, keep yourself safe. Mm-hmm. Take a small bit of exercise, which I've been doing. And I've been doing a good bit of walking now. It was tough in the beginning, Joe. Yeah, very tough. I was a very fit man. And I was getting hard to walk, we say 50, 60 metres in the beginning. I made small diaries on WhatsApp for friends of mine to show them progress and show them the horrific things people could go through with this, because I was afraid of anyone else getting it, anybody that I knew or anything. I just didn't want people getting this. Terrible. Terrible.
And were you out of work?
Oh, I'm out of work, Joe, since October.
Yeah.
I'm a supervisor in a factory, and I prepared myself 2 weeks ago that I was nearly ready to go back to work again.
Okay.
And I got another bout of chest infection and back with the doctor, and he says to me, look, you just can't go back like this. He said, you're going to undo all the hard work that you've done.
Okay.
We'll have to keep you out for another while.
And
we get
how
to
are
the
you feeling today, Mark?
Ah, Joe, I'm up and down. I have great days. I have good days. I have bad days. I have a lot of bad days. A lot of bad days. I have a lot of problems with my breathing. You know, I can get up maybe and do maybe 2.5-3 kilometres of a walk and I don't feel too bad, but when I come back and I sit in the chair, I am shattered. Energy levels, it's terrible. It's terrible.
And this is last October when you got it? Beginning of October?
Last October, yeah. early October, and I thought at this stage, when I hear people talking then about long COVID, I'm thinking to myself, jeepers, am I going to be one of these statistics? I don't know. I hope I'm not. I'm a very positive person, Joe.
We don't want to be frightened, but I'm looking. We're trying to get stats on it, but I'm, as I say, the head of the NHS Confederation, the UK, this morning is in the London Times saying they reckon it's between 5 and 10% of those people have COVID.
I was never a very heavy person. I lost 10 kilos during that fortnight in isolation.
Good God.
10 kilos. And I couldn't stop eating. I was eating day in, day out. I could not fill myself. And, okay, I put it down to maybe the steroids was doing that to me. But the amount of food that I was consuming was unreal. And still I lost 10 kilos.
Good God.
It just absolutely pulverised me. I was out on the street maybe 3 weeks after I had it, Joe, and I went out because I knew nobody had been near my car from the day I came home from work, and I needed to sterilise the steering wheel and the handles of my car. I wanted to do that.
Okay.
And a friend of mine across the road was looking at me, and he was horrified.
He didn't recognise you?
No.
Okay. And Mark, the discoloration in your legs, that worry, is that gone?
Oh, it's gone. Right, it only lasted, Joe, a couple of days.
Okay, thank God.
Thankfully, only a couple of days. Okay. And the doctor put me on more Medicare.
Okay, well,
Jesus, if that much medication went through my body, I don't know. I when I watched that programme last night,
I
said to myself, you know something, you're a very lucky man.
Yeah, well, that's a good way to look at it, Mark. Mm. Well done. It's a good frame, yeah, and the staff.
You have to be positive, Joe, and you have to move on. But sometimes, you know, your body just says to you, look, you're pushing it, you know.
Okay, well then, do what your GP says. You're still a very young man. So please God, Mark, you'll be back to the full of. I know you're on the road.
Oh, please God,
back to
please
full
God.
Of. Okay, that's Mark Johnson, above in Cavan. 51551, Mark Johnson.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Tanya Quigley Boylan is in Medfield in Massachusetts in the US. Tanya, you were in Ireland last year, and do you believe that's where you got COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, nice to talk to you, Joe. Thanks for taking
Likewise,
my call.
Yeah.
My husband and I went home with the three children in February for school vacation. We came back here to Boston around February 25th, 26th.
Right.
Maybe 5 or 6 days later, a couple of the kids are complaining of sore throat, stomach aches. Then I noticed a few of them had a temperature. And then long story short, by March 10th, actually the day the school shut down here, we all had a temperature, sore throat, shortness of breath. My husband and I were worse than the children. We went and we got tested for COVID. It took about 2 weeks to finally convince them to test us. We tested negative. We tested negative again, but I knew it was COVID. I'm actually a paramedic and a nurse, and I knew there's no other reason for why I was so short of breath. So finally in June, my husband and I tested for the antibodies and they came back positive.
Okay.
So it just, you know, it was so early in March that they didn't really have good testing facilities or even good tests. Yeah, so...
What about, Tanya, the vaccine?
Yeah.
What's happening in this...
So with the vaccine, my husband and I are firefighters, so we were the second round. So the first round was all this nursing home staff and patients. And so I actually just got my second vaccine yesterday, husband will get his on Saturday. But it depends on where you're living as far as, you know, town to town. You could be in Galway and you could get it today, and you could be in Wexford and have to wait another 4 weeks because it's ran by the towns here.
Okay.
You know, so but luckily because of our jobs we were able to get it. But people are having such difficulty getting it, and it's just really unfortunate.
And have things, I know Joe Biden is only in less than a month at this stage, but have things improved or changed or...
There seems to be more direction. There seems to be more, you know, gosh, it just feels so good to not have to worry about something new every day on the TV coming out. But it seems like there's a plan in place and there are directives coming down. So things seem like now we're going straight down a good road, down the mass pike, as they would say. But it's still slow, right, because there's so many people. I mean, teachers haven't gotten it yet. You know, and our children are in school 2 days a week.
Oh, the schools are
again,
open,
depending
are they?
On,
the schools are
say that
open.
Again now?
The schools are open.
Well, it depends on what town you're in. So in Boston, the schools are closed. They're Zooming.
Okay.
And that's only 15 miles from me. So again, you know, because state to state, it's different because nothing came down from the federal government up until now.
Yeah,
but I think things will start to trickle down. Yeah, so... It sounds like it's the same here.
Did you tell me before you voted for Donald Trump?
I did.
Is that the same time?
Well, so my husband voted for Hillary, and I voted for Donald, and because I drank the Kool-Aid, as they say.
Yeah, okay.
And so, you know, these Trump supporters that say to me, you know, oh, you're such a Democrat, you know, they get shocked when I say, well, actually, I voted for him, but I smartened up.
Okay.
I did, yeah. So okay. I drank the Kool-Aid, but my husband has since smartened me up.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you've smartened him up. Tanya, above all, you and your husband, thank you for your service and all the Irish descendants over there who are in the fire and police services. Thanks indeed. Tanya Quigley-Boylan in Massachusetts. Ruth Kennington was in sound. Maeve Mooney is our BCO and Annette Egan produced.